Good morning, everybody. We are going to call our meeting to order. It's 9:01. Briefly, and as usual, members of the public who wish to address the Housing Commission must complete a speaker request form. Thank you to those of you who have done so. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. Collective testimony by those who support or oppose an item will be limited to no more than 15 minutes total per side. Non-agenda public comments are heard at the beginning of each meeting. Those who wish to address the board about a topic that is not on the agenda must fill out a white speaker request form. Members of the public may also request to have an item pulled from the consent agenda by submitting a speaker request form prior to the start of the meeting. To speak on a matter on the agenda, members of the public must complete a speaker request form and submit it to the recording secretary before that item is called. Those who wish to speak in opposition to an item must complete the pink-colored form. Those in favor, please complete the gold-colored form. Again, thank you to those of you who have done so already. We will go ahead and move to non-agenda public comment, of which we do not have any speaker slips, but we'll give it just a second. Make a mad dash if you do want to speak. Do we have any commissioner comments? No? Wonderful. We'll move on to... Oh, yeah. Commissioner Akers.
Good morning, everyone. I just want to say thank you again for having us here and everyone that's gathered here this morning. I had the chance to visit Project Homeless Connect, and it was a really great event. I've been familiar with it for a few years, but for my first time as a commissioner, and it was just like it was becoming a point I make a lot. It's really impressive how well run this organization is. It was really, really inspiring to see so many different care providers from every level of the spectrum there providing services. I was particularly impressed by, there was a Megan Burt who works here at the commission, who I chatted with for a long time, and just the work that she's doing was just really wonderful for the prevention side and just all of the different ways that we are keeping folks from becoming homeless, serving those who are homeless. It was just really inspiring. I'm sure everyone in the room has been, but if you haven't been there, I highly encourage you to go check it out next year. And thanks for all the commission staff for doing great work.
Thank you. And report by the President Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Gentry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a number of comments from events that have occurred since the last board meeting. And I'm just going to follow right up on what Commissioner Akers was saying. The 14th annual Project Homeless Connect was held in downtown San Diego on February 26th, last week. And this time, the Project Homeless Connect served some 771 San Diegans. That is 134 fewer than last year. At least as I recall, this is the fourth year in a row we've seen a decline in numbers at this event. It crested about 4 years ago at about 1,200, between 1,100 and 1,200, and it's been coming down gradually since then, whatever that means. Hoping this, like the annual camp point in time count, that it reflects fewer out there, but at least those folks who needed the services were served. My thanks to both Commissioner Akers and also Commissioners Davis and Hubbard, who were also there and participated in this one-day resources fair. And I'm particular thanks to Commissioner Hubbard, too bad Keeley's not here. She recruited some 20 of her colleagues at Commonwealth Financial Services to volunteer at the event along with her. That's service above and beyond the call. Thank you. Project Homeless Connect provides access to a variety of services under one roof to help San Diegans experiencing homelessness meet their immediate and longer-term needs. There were approximately 100 service provider booths and more than 200 volunteers assisted during the event. Participating also were Council President Georgette Gomez and City Council Member Chris Ward. Those two individuals also served this year's honorary co-chairs. Also, Council Member Campbell visited the event as well. As I mentioned a minute ago, this is the 10th consecutive time that the Housing Commission has served as the lead organizer of Project Homeless Connect. Our major organizing partners include the City of San Diego, Father Joe's Villages, the Interfaith Shelter Network, Family Health Centers of San Diego, and the County of San Diego as part of its Living Well San Diego initiative. I'll also point out that several Housing Commission employees volunteered again this year to assist at Project Homeless Connect, and there were many donated socks and shoes from the Housing Commission employees as part of this year's effort, and we are grateful and thank each and every one of you who participated. another event that occurred last week that I need to point out to you as well is that I was able to join Chair Benvenuto and the delegation from the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce for meetings in Sacramento with state lawmakers. This is my first year joining that group, first year of the Housing Commission. Staff were represented there, and as you see in the press constantly, housing for housing affordability and homelessness are continuing to be topics of great concern in San Diego, in Sacramento for the state. Also, an event last week was the grand opening for a new property, the Paseo La Paz, located in San Ysidro, celebrated its grand opening. And I'd like to express thanks to Vice Chair Klubner for joining San Diego City Council Member Vivian Moreno, former Council Member David Alvarez, and development partners Chelsea Investment Corporation and Casa Familiar at this ribbon-cutting event. The Paseo La Paz provides some 137 affordable rental apartments for families with low income. The Housing Commission's participation was the investment of a loan of some $9.25 million toward this development, and also the issuance of some $28.6 million in tax-exempt multifamily housing bond, housing revenue bonds. These rental apartments will remain affordable for some 55 years for families with income up to 60% of the San Diego area median income, which is currently $64,200 per year for a family of four. Two other brief items having to do with issues related to Washington, D.C. and our funding and our governance from that city. On February the 12th, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson visited San Diego as part of Secretary Carson's, quote, Driving Affordable Housing Across America bus tour. I joined Secretary Carson, Mayor Faulkner, affirmed Housing President and CEO Jim Silverwood, and additional local and housing industry leaders for a roundtable discussion of housing at that meeting. The conversation included ways to reduce regulatory barriers to affordable housing and to address homelessness. I shared with Secretary Carson the importance of the flexibility the Housing Commission has for a status as a move-in-to-work agency, and our thanks to HUD for the way HUD administers that program to allow us that flexibility. The meeting with Secretary Carson took place at the Blue Water and Stella developments in the Granville community. These are two Housing Commission partnership developments with Affirmed Housing that provides some 158 affordable rental apartments for San Diegans with low income, including 87 units of which for San Diegans who had experienced homelessness. And I think it's significant that the Secretary was here and that he called out San Diego as being the only major municipal area on the West Coast that has not seen a spike in homeless numbers over the past 2 to 3 years, and reflecting the good work that we all are doing here in that arena. Also, finally, Madam Chair, a notice of something that will occur next week. I will be in Washington, D.C. to testify on Tuesday to the House of Representatives Veterans Affairs Committee Subcommittee on Economic Opportunity. Congressman Mike Levin, who chairs the subcommittee, has invited me to testify. Congressman Levin, as you recall, his district is just up the coast here in northern San Diego, southern Orange counties. This committee, the subcommittee, will be considering pending legislation related to the Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing, or VASH, housing program, VASH, VASH Housing Voucher Program. A copy of my written testimony was emailed to each of you yesterday, and I encourage you to take a look at it. I will be speaking about the challenges we have experienced in San Diego because we receive insufficient referrals from the VA San Diego healthcare system for the VASH program. I will point out that of the 1,235 VASH vouchers allocated to the Housing Commission, approximately 37%, or 460 vouchers, are not utilized because we do not receive enough referrals from the VA. I'll point out that the remaining, we have a total of about 15,500 vouchers altogether. Our non-VASH voucher program, thank you, Azuzana, has a utilization rate exceeding 100% every month. So it's not that we cannot make the program work. The program does work quite well, and it works within this economy here despite the high cost of San Diego. It's kind of hard to serve folks who are not referred to us. And that's the structural problem with the VASH housing program. My testimony does two things. Number one, it does support the pending changes recommended by Mr. Levin's committee, but it goes one step further than that. It requests that the federal government single out San Diego Housing Commission for a demonstration program and let us go ahead and utilize these 400-plus vouchers for the veterans who are on the streets needing it. What I've indicated is we can get the services done ourselves through the leadership of our Homelessness Housing Innovations Program that Lisa Jones runs so well, and we can make it work. So we will see how that plays out. But I appreciate the opportunity to be able to represent this organization in D.C. next month. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes my report for this morning.
I would like to add a comment about the VASH program, and I think that it's a tragedy when you have capacity and yet you can't get referrals from an organization that where there is a definite need. And Madam Chair, I think that it's one of those things where, as a region, we have to learn to be more aggressive in making our problems known. And I would say to you, Madam Chair, I think this is one where it'd be great to see a region letter go back to Kevin McCarthy as a voice in D.C. that has the ability to push a little harder, and being from the home state of California. And again, I think that the joint letter should be from the biggest organizations in the region, and combined with some political names as well, to underscore the need for letting us try something. Because what you're hearing from Mr. Gentry is that we can make this work. We need to be given that opportunity, and we can't resolve our homelessness problems if we aren't trying some new things. You can't fail if you never try. And the governor spent the majority of his state of the state saying we would address homelessness and housing. And here we're an organization that is being noted for the work we're doing and the work we're doing well. So I would love to work with you on trying to find out how we can get a letter done in support of what you just heard and fixing this problem.
Point well taken. I think that's an excellent idea, and I'd be happy to work with you and get started on that in conjunction with leadership here at the commission. Thank you very much, Commissioner Mitchell. Our next item is the approval of the minutes from our February 7th meeting. Do we have a motion? Moved by Commissioner Davis, seconded by Commissioner Klumpner. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. I would like to propose that item 100, the 2020-2021 procurement of property insurance coverage, go on consent. Can I do that, Chuck, also? Chuck, item 100 on consent?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Erring on the safe side. With that, if there's no objection, is there a motion for the consent calendar, item 100? Thank you, Commissioner Davis. Seconded by Commissioner Klumpner. Thank you. All those in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Okay. Item 100 is the final bond authorization for the Scripps Mesa Apartments. We do have speaker slips that have been submitted, but I would request that anybody else who may want to speak to this issue following the presentation, that you do get your speaker slips in. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Colin Miller, Vice President, Multifamily. Different presentation? Yeah, I'm not Tracy. I'll go ahead and jump into it if that's okay with you guys. So the item before you today is a request for the final bond authorization from the Housing Commission and Housing Authority for the issuance of up to $100 million in multifamily housing revenue bonds for the construction of Scripps Mesa Apartments, a proposed 264-unit multifamily development for families that will be built in multiple three-story buildings and to be located at 10380 Spring Canyon Road in the Miramar Ranch North Community of Council District 5. This mixed-use project will have 53 affordable units that will remain affordable for the next 55 years. The Scripps Mesa Apartments is proposed, as I mentioned, this is my map, it's supposed to look in the Miramar Ranch North Community area. The project is a unique public and private partnership opportunity to provide rental housing, both affordable and market rate, along with community and retail space, as well as a dedicated building for a new student makerspace and community-centered building. This project is being developed under a long-term ground lease and joint occupancy agreement with Scripps Mesa Apartments LP and the San Diego Unified School District. Residential project amenities include a clubhouse and leasing center, a fitness center, dog run, pool and spa, as well as an indoor-outdoor community gathering space. Additionally, there will be an approximately 2,000-square-foot neighborhood retail space, as well as an additional 4,000-square-foot space utilized by the San Diego Unified School District for a new student center building. There are a few depictions of the artist rendering of the community, as well as a pool and recreation area, and an aerial view of the proposed project. The developer is requesting the issuance of bonds in the amount up to $100 million in tax-exempt multifamily housing revenue bonds. I would like to note there are no Housing Commission loan funds proposed for this project. The developer of the project will be Scripps Mesa LLC and Essex Scripps LLC. Munner Group is a local family-owned and operated business with more than 11,000 residential units and over 50 developments in the San Diego region. Essex Property Trust Public has interest in 245 apartment communities comprising over 59,500 apartment homes. This includes ownership in 19 properties that comprise 5,440 units in the San Diego region alone. Both partners have a proven track record to implement, develop, and manage tax-exempt bond and tax credit transactions, as evidenced by their extensive portfolios. The total development cost of the project will be approximately $113 million, which equates to just over $429,000 per unit for the proposed 1-, 2-, and 3-bedroom units, and will be financed with a combination of 4% tax credits, tax-exempt multifamily housing revenue bonds, and developer equity. Under the proposed financing, 53 affordable units will be restricted to rents at 50% of area median income, as noted in Table 6 of the staff report. These are the requested actions are the final steps needed to issue these bonds. After this meeting, if approved, we would move on to the Housing Authority for their approval as well. These bonds would not constitute a debt of the city. The bonds will not financially obligate the city, the Housing Authority, or the Housing Commission, because security for the repayment of the bonds will be limited to specific private revenue sources of the project. If approved, the estimated financing closing will occur in April of 2020, with a targeted construction completion of June 2022. This concludes my presentation. I can click through the slides if you'd like, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I think we're okay without a click through, but commissioners, feel free to change that. We'll go ahead and get started with our speakers. We'll start with those speakers in opposition. I'll call all of them so you can come up and speak. We have Jeff Anson, Peter Bonovich, and Gene Feinstein. You'll all have 3 minutes each.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Anson from Law Office of Craig Sherman, who represents Voice of Scripps Ranch. What was missing from the presentation, what's missing from your backup materials, is that a lawsuit was filed on January 28, 2020, regarding the project. An electronic copy has been sent. I also have a paper courtesy copy here that I'll leave. And it's somewhat troubling that this information, which I believe is very pertinent to your consideration, was not before you, and as far as I know, none of you know about this lawsuit. Briefly, the project is challenged by this lawsuit and litigation on the grounds that it cannot be processed as a ministerial project, which is how it's being processed right now, and as well, it violates the Miramar Ranch North Community Plan and other zoning and development laws as set forth in the petition, of which you now have a copy. Briefly, the project has a de minimis commercial and school space. It's an extremely small portion of the overall project size. The project conflicts with the planned and intended use of the area as either a small shopping center or community center set forth in the plan. The project does not comply with the plan's requirements for common visitor serving and aesthetic effect. The project exceeds the objective density per net acre limits in the community plan, and the dense apartment community housing as slated for a different area within that community plan. I would like to note that there are other speakers who members of the community and speakers who are part of Voice of Scripps Ranch. You also should have received a email submittal from Lisa Kroner. Briefly, she discusses a community perspective on this project and the number of luxury units that are being put in as opposed to something that is more community-based, more affordable housing, or if you consider that this was originally a school space, which they've had to move in order to put this project forward. Again, I'm leaving a copy here. I can leave it with your assistant, and thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the speaker.
Yes, I told Congress.
Obviously I'm new to this, but I'm quite intrigued by it. Is the intent of the lawsuit to stop the project as a whole?
The intent of the lawsuit is to have it conform with community planning and have it processed correctly. Right now, it's being ministerial processed.
So I want to make sure I'm clear on this as this is an agenda item. So when you say conform with the community plan,
right,
that means what?
It has a number of conflicts with the community plan.
Meaning it's too big? It's not. On one hand, Mrs. Kroner's letter says we want more affordable units. But on this hand, the lawsuit says it doesn't conform to the community plan.
Well, it needs to conform with the community plan. It has conflicts. Those have to be resolved. Whether we all want, depending on what we want or don't want, it does have to follow the law.
Okay.
And it has to go through something more than a ministerial process.
So the community is okay with having the 254 units, but there are changes within the plan that need to be made.
I would refer that to the Voice of Scripps Ranch and Mr. Craig Sherman.
We'll have a few more speakers, so let's maybe we'll see some answers to the questions from you, Commissioner, there. And if not, we'll have plenty of time following to ask more Commissioner questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Peter Bonovich, and then Gene Feinstein, please.
Good morning. My name is Peter Bonovich. I am not Lisa Kroner, but Lisa was scheduled to speak today, but she was unable to come. She's a colleague and a fellow member of the Voice of Scripps Ranch, the organization that is opposing this development. Lisa and I both live near the site of the planned apartments, and we're also, as I said, a member of the Voice of Scripps Ranch. We're asking that you deny bond funds for this project. We are in favor of more affordable housing in Scripps Ranch and everywhere in San Diego. We're willing to compromise in order to achieve reasonable development in the Scripps Ranch area. This project, though, is an example of how not to address affordable housing. First of all, I think you should look at the plan carefully that is before you. This is a plan that would provide 53 affordable units and 211 luxury units. That's 80% luxury units. And those are the true interest of Monarch Development. That is their main motivation. They want these bonds in order to underwrite their enterprise, which is a profit-making enterprise based on the 211 luxury units. Second of all, the planning and approval process for this project has been filled with missteps. The Scripps Mesa apartments would violate, as the gentleman before me, Mr. Anson, said, would seriously violate the Miramar Ranch North Community Plan in many respects. That plan is a piece of legislation, in effect, that is supposed to guide development in the area. There were stipulations early on that this project would have to go through a more detailed city approval and long-range planning process to determine whether amendments to the city to the community plan would be necessary. That process was ignored in the early stages of the project. It simply didn't happen, and the map waiver request a few months ago, which would have inaugurated a more detailed planning process and set of procedures by the city, that process never really took place because Monarch Development withdrew their map waiver request. So the process has never been properly, the project has never been properly vetted through the city's developmental procedures and planning procedures. That activity, that failure on the part of the developers, is wrong and it's illegal, and it's one of the subjects of the lawsuit that Mr. Anson has mentioned. The school district and Monarch, frankly, have abused their power in this case. The community voted 5 times not to approve the project as it was previously planned, as it is now planned, and was presented to the community organizations in Scripps Ranch.
One final sentence, please.
The district has stonewalled the community's concerns. We ask that you deny the request here because the rules really have not been properly followed in this case.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Gene Feinstein.
My name is Jean Feinstein. I've been a resident of Scripps Ranch for 22 years. I'm also a member of the Voice of Scripps Ranch, a citizens group that opposes the construction by Monarch Scripps Mesa on Scripps Ranch property owned by the San Diego Unified School District. I'm writing to ask you deny bond funds to Monarch in the amount of $100 million for the construction of these luxury apartments on the site. Please note that there is currently a lawsuit filed against the City of San Diego, Monarch, and the San Diego Unified School District relative to the legality of this project, lack of compliance with North Scripps Planning Commission regulations, improper permitting, and other issues. A motion hearing civil is scheduled for March 27th. More than 3 weeks after the meeting of today. There has been much misuse of public funds to date, which indicates fiduciary irresponsibility on the part of government agencies. Bond funds from Propositions S, Z, and YY have been used to relocate the Charter School Innovations Academy from this site, known as Scripps Mesa, to a new site in an industrial part of Kearney Mesa. Those bond funds were approved by citizens of San Diego for the purpose of renovating, repairing, and revitalizing city schools. They included our added money for technology, safety and security updates, complying with ADA requirements. SC and YY have been used for land acquisition and construction of Innovations Academy at its new site. $54 million have already been used. That would come up to a total of over $100 million using servicing fees. In exchange for that, the lease will pay to the school district $41 million over 66 years. And I just noticed that the reduced cost housing is, and what was mentioned here or in your writing, for a period of 55 years, not the 66 years of the lease. Monarch is asking the City of San Diego for $100 million to use to construct 264 luxury rental units. Of that number, 53 have been identified as affordable. No one can deny the need for affordable housing, but they represent 20% of the project or $20 million of the requested bond funds. The city has asked for $80 million to underwrite a for-profit project. As a taxpayer, I can only characterize this as fiduciary irresponsibility, something I suspect you all understand. Again, I ask you to deny the requested bond funds for the Monarch project.
Thank you. We'll be moving into speakers in favor, and we'll start with Sarah Kruer-Jager. I'm so sorry in advance. And she'll be followed by Eric Schreiner, Marco Gonzalez, and Angelica Roca.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, distinguished commissioners. My name is Sarah Kruer-Jager. I've been with Monarch. I'm a partner there. I've been with the firm for close to 15 years. On behalf of our entire team, I want to first thank the San Diego Housing Commission staff for their presentation, for their work on this project. Monarch and Essex, we are pursuing this bond issuance because we truly believe that we are all blessed to live in this amazing city and region. And for it to continue to be innovative and forward-thinking and looking, we need more housing options. Anyone who wants to should be able to afford housing in Miramar Ranch North, Scripps Ranch, and in every other part of our great city. This issue affects all of us. Today, there are currently no affordable or market-rate rental units in the Miramar Ranch North community. And this site is likely one of the last opportunities to provide these types of housing options in this highly desirable community. We've worked hard in partnership with the district over the past 5+ years and are especially excited to create 53 new affordable rental housing units, which will be affirmatively marketed to qualifying district employees. So, you know, for the district employees, that could include teachers and early childhood educators, school police officers, bus drivers, school nurses, administrative and custodial workers, and the list goes on. Many affordable housing advocates, community members, and potential residents have expressed their support for this project throughout the years. And I think the bottom line is that this project will allow individuals and families with a range of incomes the ability to live, work, and play in an area which currently has limited housing options, while also creating opportunities for school district employees in particular to live affordably near their place of work, which, by the way, happens to be at some of the very best schools in the district. We have a long ways to go regionally, and we are committed to partnering with the district to provide needed mixed-income housing and to be a part of the solution. We look forward to continuing engagement with key stakeholders in moving this precedent-setting project forward and realizing all of the benefits that it will bring to the community, the taxpayers, and to the school district. I think we have a lot of opportunity to do good here with this, and so I please ask that you support the final bond authorization and issuance and allow this process to move forward. The one other thing I will just add in response that we'll get into a little bit more, but, you know, amid the housing crisis that we all find ourselves in, this project, we believe, is a much-needed community investment, and again, in an area with zero apartments and zero affordable. We've been through a years-long approval process on this, numerous community meetings, and we believe that this meritless lawsuit is frankly just the latest tactic by a handful of individuals desperate and determined to stop much-needed housing from being built. Thank you. Yeah.
I'm going to go back to a question I asked earlier. During the numerous community meetings, and again, I'm new to this, and I'm going to have a lot of questions, was the community's focus on no development, or was it on the mix of the development? Because what we've heard is there's a complaint about the number of units that are going to be offered to the school district employees of 53. Mm-hmm. Were there meetings and discussions about there need to be more units offered, or were the meetings more around this development's too big for the area?
Sure. I'll address that, and then could I also call up one of my colleagues, kind of chime in? We've heard a lot of, and I was at pretty much every single one of those meetings. We've heard a lot of different things. So just based on what we heard, first it was we don't want any project there. It was very focused on the charter school. We've heard, frankly, again, some pretty awful things in public testimony that we don't want those people in our community, those kids going to our schools. So just kind of answering your question candidly, we've heard a lot of different things. I'm not sure what
As I'm going to be sitting here hearing about projects like this, I do believe that it's important for us to understand, you know, again, the lawsuit has been filed, but if the community was open to, we want to build the units because we see the need, or was it, no, we don't want this, and look, we're always going to hear comments about the type of housing. I think San Diego has to realize that we're all people. Everybody puts their clothes on one leg at a time, and no one, it's about humanity and being humane. And having housing, and for the people who teach in our school systems that struggle to find a place to live and have to drive from Murrieta and Moreno Valley to teach, that's absolutely unacceptable. So I look forward to hearing the next speaker. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Eric Schreiner, followed by Marco Gonzalez, and then Angelica Roca.
Good morning. My name is Eric Schreiner. I'm general counsel for the Monarch Group, and I just want to touch on a few of the points that have been raised this morning. We started this process about 4 to 5 years ago. When we were initially doing our land use review, we went ahead and submitted what they call a preliminary review application with the City of San Diego, the Development Services Department, and the intent of that was to confirm that this project could be processed as a ministerial project, because we wanted to confirm that very early in the process. And the city did confirm that, and the city also confirmed in that preliminary review that no community plan amendment would be required for this project because it would be consistent with the community plan designations and also the zoning designation that the city has given to this site. As part of the process for the ground lease and joint occupancy agreement to be approved, I just want to point out that the school district did a full environmental impact report that was submitted to the public for public review and comments. There were public hearings on that, and the school district certified that environmental impact report, I think about a year and a half ago now. As to the site's current use, it was originally built as a temporary elementary school site. That school for San Diego Unified was relocated about 1,000 feet to the east of the school site in a permanent facility. Because this school site was then became available, a charter school, Innovations Charter School, located onto the site. Now, when they built out this school site, it was all temporary classroom trailers. It was only intended to be used for a limited period of time, and the trailers now are well past their lifespan. So the school district does have bond money just for charter schools. It's allocated to charter schools, and that's the bond money that was used to relocate Innovation Charter School and then give them a permanent home. So they are not going to have a permanent home in a building that's going to be completely rehabilitated now, so that they will not have to relocate in the future. And also the charter school will be paying those bonds through its own revenue. So I believe it doesn't have any impact on the school district's revenue. And we're available to answer any other questions you might have about any land use issues.
Excuse me. Is there a hearing currently scheduled in the Superior Court?
There is. There's been a demurrer filed by us to go ahead and see if we can go ahead and get the petition dismissed.
Has there been a request for a temporary restraining order?
There has been no request for a temporary restraining order.
Has there been a hearing set for a preliminary injunction?
Not to my knowledge. Our legal counsel, Mark Wibbenvalls, can answer any questions about the litigation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Marco Gonzalez.
Thank you, members of the commission. Marco Gonzalez with Coast Law Group. I am a litigation counsel for Monarch, but I was also with Eric, part of the entitlement team. So I was participating over a number of years in the community as this project moved forward. As was mentioned, this project has been through a full EIR at San Diego Unified. And for all the opposition that we got, we were frankly quite surprised that no one challenged us on the EIR. But what happened is they've now kind of Johnny-come-lately tried to take a second bite at the apple, and they've come to the city of San Diego and filed what really will be determined to be a frivolous lawsuit and claimed that there were a litany of issues that weren't addressed. But if you go back to the EIR, they were actually addressed. They were addressed as potential land use impacts, and they were all discarded as not significant impacts. And a consistency finding was made with the community plan, with all the appropriate land use controls at the city of San Diego. The city of San Diego, as a responsible agency, went through the document, had no response, implicitly agreed with the findings of San Diego Unified. Now, that being said, there are some statements in your staff report that I would like to make sure get corrected. Specifically, there's reference to the notice of determination. It was executed in May of 2018, but it was actually filed on June 20th of 2018. I would hope that that gets corrected in any resolution that gets put out by the commission. Similarly, there is kind of boilerplate reference to subsequent discretionary review. And in fact, as Eric mentioned, this is a by right project and the discretionary review has already occurred. When the Housing Authority issued its decision on the preliminary bond offering, they made a very important finding at that time that the bond offering is not a project. That was applicable to the entirety of the bond offering, and I believe it would be appropriate to reference that in any commission resolution, and we expect that the Housing Authority will reiterate that. And so while you typically may not get a project at this stage before you that's already been through that EIR process, this is one where, because of the joint use nature of the agreement with San Diego Unified and the lease there, we've already been through all of that CEQA review. And in fact, you can confidently look at that record and say that we're done. The statute of limitations has passed. As well, the limitations have passed on that CEQA determination made by the Housing Authority in the context of the preliminary offering. Now, as Eric mentioned, we have a hearing. The hearing will take place on March 27th to hear our demur to hopefully just stop the nonsense. And the reason I say stop the nonsense is because at every step of the way, the opposition that's been put up by the community has been typical NIMBY nonsense. As Sarah mentioned, you know, they started off with a litany of arguments. The first was, don't put multifamily in our community. We're not a multifamily community. We are a single-family residential community. Yeah, you have no apartments. You have no place for anybody who can't afford to buy a $700,000 to $1 million home to actually live in your community. That's why we're there. That's why San Diego Unified wanted to do this joint use project. They next said, oh, wait, we only want commercial. And then they said, wait, we really just want an expansion of the adjacent park. At no time, despite every effort to communicate with the locals, did they say, we want to sit down and talk about the mix. We want to sit down and talk about how a multifamily project can be better integrated. We tried. We got stonewalled. And then we heard the typical thing that you hear when you propose affordable housing. Well, are their kids going to go to our schools? And how are you going to police it? As a matter of fact, they said, because you're including a student maker space, you're inviting people to come and live in affordable housings, and they're going to have guns adjacent to a school facility. It was nonsensical. And so, Commissioner Mitchell, just to answer your question, no, they don't want the project in any form. I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you. I believe Mr. Christensen does.
Yeah. Statute of limitations for a challenge to an environmental impact report is 90 days, is it not?
If a notice of determination is filed, it's 30 days.
Okay.
And that ran on July 21st, 2018.
And no suit was filed?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, we have one final speaker, Angelica Rocha.
Hi, Commissioners. My name is Angelica Rocha, and I am representing Circulate San Diego, a local nonprofit transportation and land use planning and advocacy organization. Circulate San Diego has a program called the Circulate Mobility Certification, which reviews and certifies sustainable growth projects that meet a merit of criteria, including active transportation, proximity to transit, and pedestrian-friendly design. An independent review panel reviewed this. This panel included urban designers, developers, planners, engineers, and this project earned a mobility certification. I am here today to urge the Commission to recommend the Housing Authority to authorize the bond request for the Scripps Mesa Joint Occupancy Project. This project will include 20% low-income units and 200-plus market rate. The reality is we need more housing, but we also need to be reasonable about the balance between luxury, market, and affordable. This project highlights how public-private investment can work together to make strides in our housing crisis. As you likely know, there are no affordable units in the or market rate rentals in this community, a community I, in fact, grew up in. I grew up in an apartment down the street, one of the only units in the area. The longer we delay, the more expensive housing units become, and market rate will then be shut out, but you all know this. In addition to the mixed housing, this project will include 2,000 square feet of neighborhood-serving retail and commercial space, 4,000 for the school district. A speaker before me mentioned the need for shopping center, and I would argue that is absolutely not what is needed here. There's a giant shopping center across the street. I am confident this project will serve the community and the future community who wish to live in this area. And we can set a precedent here of smart development and public-private partnerships in San Diego for many years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rocha. With that, I would actually, before we go to commissioner comments, Mr. Christensen, could you quickly weigh in with regard to some of the lawsuit talk and where that places us?
Yeah, yes, thank you very much. The lawsuit was filed on January, and I just saw this a half an hour ago, was filed January 28th, 2020, and it's against the City of San Diego. The reason it's against the City of San Diego is all of the issues being raised are zoning and land use issues. This body has no authority over those issues. There's an ability for a plaintiff to go into Superior Court and seek a temporary restraining order. They need to be able to prove that there's irreparable harm that's going to occur and that there's no other remedy available at law, and importantly, that they're likely to proceed. The court must determine that they're likely to proceed if they go to trial. That's a high standard, and that's the reason I asked the question, is whether or not there was a request for a preliminary injunction. There was not. There's been no notice filed for a preliminary injunction. And the San Diego Housing Commission has not been named as a defendant in the lawsuit. We're often named, or regardless of whether it's proper. So the fact there's a lawsuit, I understand, but it's something between the city and the opponents. So in my view, this isn't within the purview of the Housing Commission, and you should determine whether or not the bonds comply with the law, and to my knowledge, they do, and that's what you're to vote on today.
Thank you. We'll open it up for commissioner questions now. Vice Chair Klippner.
Thank you for the clarification on that. I remember this project the first time we voted on it, and it's interesting because I was thinking back, and I don't remember any speakers against it. So very curious to see this all come out at the last second here. I appreciate our counsel sort of echoing what I was thinking, even without that astute legal opinion. I'm not a land use attorney. None of us are land use attorneys. Even if we were, this is not the proper venue to settle all those issues that were brought up. So I'm going to put those aside completely. However, I do want to address the opposition because this is more than just this one project. These are things that we hear on other projects, and I think it's important that we be very clear about the message on this. And I'm watching this play out in my own neighborhood, so I'm going to say to you exactly what I would say to my own neighbors, which is I heard everything you said. I appreciate some of the acknowledgments that, you know, we are in a housing crisis, but ... we want more affordable housing in our community, but ... My problem is that I'm just not having it with the buts. There's always a but. There's always a reason not to. And the reality and what we should be focused on here is the housing crisis, and in particular, the affordability crisis. And what do we have in front of us? We have 53 units of affordable housing at 50% AMI, which is less than $1,300 for a three-bedroom, which seems like a huge benefit to a lot of a lot of families and this community as a whole. I'm not concerned about the market rate units. The reason I'm not concerned about the market rate units, and I'm just not interested in this argument that, you know, maybe the ratio should be more affordable housing. We don't have any SDHC loan dollars on the line here, do we? There's a lot of projects that we do need that money for to make them work, to generate production. And so if we have a project that is in a north of eight community with no affordable housing, 53 units, we're not putting down any loan money, I don't know how in our right minds we could do anything other than welcome, embrace, and approve this project. So those are my opinions. Thank you to everyone for coming out today. I look forward to seeing this project break ground.
Any other commissioner comments or questions?
I will.
Commissioner Mitchell?
And I will ask that my fellow commissioners oblige me this statement, because I want everyone to understand how I come into this discussion and this responsibility. We live in a region where you heard one of the speakers mention the NIMBY aspects, and I refer to it on a different note. I refer to it as the IGM aspect, the I got mine. And there are a lot of people that have that belief. I got mine. I don't care about anybody else. That is absolutely unfortunate, and it's heartbreaking. I think the community concerns are always going to be something I'm going to take a great interest in as we talk about projects, and are we really addressing those concerns realistically? Someone could argue that it's a he said, she said when one of the speakers said what we heard was the traditional comments about why the project isn't good. And I will say that I grew up as one of those people that are being referred to, blue-collar family working hard, there was no other option but to work hard and struggle to pay the rent pay the mortgage. And so when you hear comments that aren't about real concerns, potentially, they're just about, I don't want the project, you know, we'll never solve our housing crisis. We'll never be a great region or a great city unless we truly try and address the problems around housing and transportation, because those are two things that everybody has to deal with. And I think that we always have to remember that this is about valuing people. No matter what income you make, no matter where you are in the socioeconomic status or ladder, valuing people is something we're supposed to do every single day. And I think that in the end, I remember when I was chairing the San Diego Food Bank, for 4 years, I learned a lot about the value of people, people who would stand in line to get food from us because the rent was absorbing every dime they had. And they were being forced to drive 2 hours to get to and from work. And what I learned, and I tell people this all the time, we all want the same thing in life, which is to be fed and to be sheltered. And for the people who are living in their cars, the people who can't find a place to live, everyone should have the same feeling about those folks, which is that is truly sad, and where we can provide opportunity to shelter them and make sure that they have a place and a roof over their head, we should all be on the same page. And I will look at every project through that lens. Are the concerns being addressed? But more importantly, are the concerns legitimate, or is it really just about IGM? I got mine, and I don't want you. I don't care about you. So I will say that, and I appreciated Commissioner Klumpner's comments as well. Thank you.
Any other commissioner comments? Commissioner Akers?
Yeah, I have some questions. For Commissioner Mitchell, I think we have like one more meeting of the newbie round, and then we're going to have to be caught up to speed. But, so forgive us again, and thank you all again so much for coming out. Do we know what the plans are for there's 4,000 square feet of space for San Diego Unified on site? It's like a maker's lab. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I'll need to defer to the developer to explain the exact use of that space.
Okay, thank you. I'm interested in that. And then I would also just kind of and also if we've identified what the 2,000 square feet of commercial will be.
Sorry about that. So the 4,000 square foot makerspace was kind of a requirement of the district based on the public-private partnership. And the intent there is for it to be a steam facility going in. So a multi-purpose facility that will serve not only kind of the schools within the district, but also district-wide. And it would also double kind of after hours and on the weekends as a community center be available to the community. And then with respect to the 2,000 square feet of commercial, we haven't identified specific tenants yet, but, you know, it would be neighborhood serving, and it may also be some sort of complementary use with the STEAM facility. So could be private tutors or something like that, serving more of an educational or after-school type purpose, or coffee shop or something like that, neighborhood serving.
Some specifics on the project. Are there going to be separate entrances for the individuals in the affordable units versus the market units?
Absolutely not.
And it sounds like there's going to be some incredible amenities on site. Are all of the amenities at the project going to be available to both the market units and affordable units?
For the entire community, yes. Yes, sir.
We consider it, I think, like a success when we get 10% on site at 60% AMI, and we're looking at 20% on site at 50% AMI. For this project, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's good. I would just agree with Mr. Clinton over here. We're both with Claremont. I think that a lot of the arguments that are being made are interesting. I'd say I think this is a good partnership, and I'm looking forward to moving forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any final commissioner? No. One victory lap. Okay, Commissioner Clinton.
I just want to add too that I appreciate the questions about the you know the kind of feeling of the experience of the project and all those things. I think I can sometimes skip right over that, and I'm just interested in like how many units, like you know what's this costing. But and so thank you for those questions. I do want to point out though that you know we're not taking any position on the deal with the school district here, and I have no idea. I mean, I think it's great that we're getting all of this, all this works out. You know, again, to the opponents here, it's not our job to consider whether this was a smart financial decision by the school district. It's our job to consider whether this is a sound housing investment and a good use of bond funds that we should authorize. And so I just want to make very clear here, that's what we're all weighing in on, not the financials of every other step of this project, and there were other places that that should have been addressed if there were concerns about that.
Commissioner Hester.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. I want to thank everyone who spoke at the in front of us and explained what is your thoughts and feelings about this development. I can tell you that as I listen to everyone speak, I think about the child care provider who takes care of my daughter, who has been living in her parents' loft area, living room area with her two kids, and waiting to find affordable housing in Scripps Ranch, simply because there isn't any. So you're right, 53 isn't enough. 53 affordable housing for our school district's employees to compete over. It is not enough, but it would be a bad deal for me to vote this down because no one else is building. So that's my sentiment about this development. And I'm excited that we're finally building affordable housing in Scripps Ranch. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Hester. I just have a couple quick comments, not to repeat anything that my fellow commissioner said. However, one of the speakers referenced a 4 to 5 year land use review process that brought us to today. To the folks who have feelings regarding whether or not this is luxury that is comprised of the market rate is unfortunately hard to distinguish from luxury these days because it takes 4 to 5 years in land use review, and that's a lot of money that you don't recoup. That money gets passed on. So I think we collectively have a lot of momentum in this room around the general cost of home building and the process. And I would welcome your sentiment behind some reforms to that process to make market rate a little bit more affordable to everybody else so that when we look at market rate, we're not automatically talking luxury, which unfortunately today is very often the case. Colin, am I correct that this is just an 80-20 deal with some special caveats?
That is correct.
Okay. So the 80-20 makeup of this project, the 80% market rate, the 20% affordable, is actually a spread that we often strive for when we're looking for these developments. And so I think that the developer has done an excellent job getting it to this point. I do appreciate, you know, 50-some units at 55% AMI. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. There's a small person kicking me, like, climbing up. which is very inappropriate, and I apologize. However, it's inappropriate for me. I'm just going full TMI, or IGM. So, but I do hope that when we go into the workshop component of financing, that we do talk a little bit about the 80-20, because I think that those deals where they used to be so traditional and something that this commission saw regularly, as we get into more creative opportunities to see more affordable housing built alongside market rate, that we just want to keep a connection back to the fundamentals of how some of this stuff gets financed. But again, you know, 4 to 5 years in a land use review process, plus a series of lawsuits, plus rising costs in that time, these things all add up and result in exceptionally expensive housing. And I think we're all sensitive to that, and I would welcome any effort to help us lower those costs. But I think we're looking for, without any further questions, a motion. Moved by Commissioner Clark.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Mitchell. You get it for enthusiasm. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you again to the speakers who made time to be here today. We will be moving on to the workshop components of today's meeting. I'm sorry, we have comments from Mr. Gentry. Go for it.
Just a couple of preliminary comments about the workshops. As I mentioned at the last board meeting, particularly for the newbies, there are newbies, not NIMBYs, newbies. Or maybe yibbies, yes, on this board or something like that. There are 4 major lines of business of this organization, plus a handful of smaller boutique-type operations. Last month, we were able to talk with you about the properties that we own and operate, the 3,700-plus doors of units, and talk about how that part of our portfolio. And today we're going to talk about two of the other major lines of business. The first is housing finance, which pertains to the property you just heard about, as well as all the others that we do. And then the second workshop, we'll hear about our homelessness housing innovations department, which is one that we've grown just in big time terms just over the last 5 or 6 years. We'll have further workshops in the near future on our largest program, which is the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is the backbone of the organization, and also a number of other boutique operations, including our home ownership programs, the asset management and third party we do for the county, as well as others, and other operations out there. But this is an effort on the part of staff to make sure the board has a full, or at least a cursory understanding of the full range of what we do. And thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, good morning. My name is Emily Jacobs, Senior Vice President of Housing Finance and Property Management. With me today is Mike Pafko, Senior Vice President of Real Estate Development and Portfolio Management. Today we will be providing a general overview of the Multifamily Housing Revenue Bond and Low-Income Housing Tax Credit programs. We would be happy to answer any questions at the conclusion of the presentation. The mission of the Housing Commission is to provide affordable, safe, quality homes for low and moderate income families and individuals in the city of San Diego, and to provide opportunities to improve the quality of life for the families that we serve. One of the many ways we do this is by partnering with developers to build new housing and to preserve existing. We do this by issuing bonds, which are typically coupled with tax credits as part of the overall financing strategy. The bond program has been an important investment tool for the city and the Housing Authority since 1982. The Housing Commission's program has been in place since 1989. The Housing Commission and the Housing Authority, which is the public agency authorizing the multifamily housing revenue bonds, has been vital and important, as I mentioned, since the 80s. The Housing Commission, utilizing the Housing Authority's tax-exempt status, passes on lower interest rate financing to developers. Its authority to issue bonds is limited under the U.S. IRS code. The process to obtain bonds is the Housing Commission, as the sponsor, applies with the developer to the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee. Prior to application, the project is brought before the Housing Commission, Housing Authority, and City Council. A bond inducement resolution must be obtained prior to application submittal to CIDLAC and a City Council Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, or TEFRA, resolution must be obtained. This event is important as it starts the clock on the eligible cost the project can attribute to the bonds. As mentioned, federal law limits how much each state receives in bond cap. This is referred to as the annual state ceiling. The limit is determined by the state's overall population. The 2020 bond cap is just over $4.1 billion. I should note that there are different items that go against that bond cap, and a small portion of which is housing. The Housing Commission issues bonds subject to the Housing Authority approval. It's important to note that the Housing Commission, the city, and the Housing Authority are not financially liable to repay the bonds. Those are repaid through project sources. If the project cannot repay the bondholders bear the loss. The bond program does come with various restrictions. A developer must commit to a minimum of 20% of units set aside for incomes at or below 50% AMI, or 40% at or below 60% AMI. The project must remain affordable for 55 years. Bonds can be publicly offered or privately placed, and 95% of bond proceeds must be allocated to capital cost. The economic benefits of tax-exempt bonds is the lower interest rate and the ability to utilize 4% low-income housing tax credits. Blue Water is an example of a bond and tax credit deal. The project is 79 units of affordable housing for families and veterans. The project issued $19.5 million in bonds. CIDLAC requires issuers, such as the Commission, to provide annual compliance reports. These reports are due in March. The Commission works closely with developers to ensure compliance with the resolution and regulatory agreement. The Commission submits all required information through CIDLAC's online reporting portal. As part of the Commission and City's audit cycles, staff monitors the outstanding balances at the close of each fiscal year. The balances are confirmed with the bond trustee and/or developers. Staff compiles the information and provides the data to City staff. And with that, Mike will be providing a riveting overview of tax credits.
Thank you, Emily. You did save the fun part for me. So, you know, this is something of a complicated topic that we're trying to simplify. But if you have any questions, just feel free to stop us. We're happy to, you know, explain any slides and go into any more detail. I'm happy to make this more interactive. So this is just a snapshot of the topics that we're hoping to cover within the tax credit program. And we thought we'd start with just a little bit of the history of the tax credit program. So it was formed in 1986 under an IRS regulation as a mechanism to fund affordable housing with a public-private type partnership. And the program provides affordable developers with federal tax credits that are sold to private investors, and those investors contribute the equity back to the project to be able to develop and to build. And here are just a couple of statistics that we thought might be interesting to give you an idea of the magnitude of the program. So since it was created in 1986, tax credits have financed nearly 3 million affordable apartments, and annually it creates about 110,000 new homes nationwide. And in a typical year, the low-income housing tax credit program supports about 95,000 jobs. So there are different types of buildings that tax credits can go to, including new construction, acquisition, rehab, and really in all parts of the country, so urban, rural, and suburban locations. Also, populations served include low-income families, seniors, individuals with special needs, and homeless. Recently, with the new tax regulations that changed, we can now go up to 80% of area median income for the tax credit program with income blending, and tenants will pay 30% of their household income in rent. So now we're going to talk a little bit about how tax credits work, this is where it gets a little bit more technical. But so each state receives a per capita amount of tax credits annually to allocate to the projects.
Come back on the slide where you said, you know, the tax credit program finances approximately 110,000 affordable homes for low incomes nationwide, nearly 3 million affordable apartments since. So, I mean, that, you know, when you look at the number, first glance, 110,000 low-income homes for nation for 50 states. I mean, it kind of stands out as it's a half-hearted effort. Is that a fair? I mean, I would assume that that's. I mean, we could build 110,000 in California alone.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, Rick. Oh, I'm sorry.
Half-hearted is a good word. Restricted, limited by law is another one, another good term. When the tax credits were set up, this is a cost to the taxpayers indirectly through lost revenues. And so it's never been open-ended. It's always been limited from the initial Tax Credit Act. This was part of the Tax Reform Act of 1986 and replaced a whole host of former affordable housing efforts that if you really want to be bored, I can get into with you, that don't apply anymore. There were tax credit, there were tax subsidy programs, there were direct payment subsidies, and a number. And a lot of scandals in the late 70s, how a number of them did not work. So when tax credits were set up, it was part of the last major tax reform in this country. It was to set up a private-to-private funding system without going through government, but with government authorization, but limited to what the lawmaker felt at the time was affordable to the country. The ceiling on this could be raised any time the Congress wants to do so, but they'd have to score it against the budget to do it. And so the industry is always lobbying to get this increased, but the issue is going to be how far and how much. It's been increased a couple of times over the years.
Madam Chair, this is one of those where, again, the region needs to be loud and vocal on this. You know, this needs to be a number one priority for the chamber trip to D.C. every year. It needs to be a number one priority for the delegation, is that, you know, it's long overdue for raising it. And I will counter one thing that is the perception, is that this goes against the taxpayer. When you create housing that is affordable and you leave people the opportunity to have disposable income, they spend said disposable income in the economy, which creates sales tax revenues, which benefits, you know, streets and roads and libraries and all their stuff. So, again, old school thought, long overdue for change. But, again, this should be one of those where the chamber and all the other organizations when we're in D.C. should be saying, we have an affordable housing problem and you could fix it by, even if you raise it and give us a 10-year window, we can build a lot.
And staff would welcome this board as aggressive as you all want to be in helping increase our resources. This is great.
Let me figure out where we were. Okay, so we're talking a little bit about like how the tax credits are calculated and how they're allocated. And sort of to your point, you know, we are obviously woefully underfunded to be able to build as much affordable housing as we need. I guess the good news for California is that we have over 39 million people and they're allocated per capita. So we get the lion's share of tax credits to California, but obviously we have part of the greatest need. So part of the allocations that you're going to see involve those tax credits flowing from the federal government to the state and then allocated locally, and it's based on population. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Further allocated by population for each municipality? Like, do we have to fight for our share of the state's allocation? Or
there's a couple different apportionments. So part of it is to each municipality within California. So LA gets the largest, San Diego gets a pretty healthy chunk, and then about half of it's located or allocated by special needs, rural, other special set asides that the state identifies in their qualified allocation plan. But about half of it's regional and about half of it's special interest.
One more question. So is the cost of housing in different regions factored in at all, or is it just straight per capita? We're getting the same amount of money per head as New Mexico.
Well, on the federal level, it's per capita. So it looks at population, and then the overall federal government looks at what that population is, and then they decide what portion of the tax credits go. So, I mean, I guess that's a good
even
point.
Even with wide disparities in the cost of housing, California is still getting the same amount per person as a place that has very low cost of housing.
That's my understanding. I don't know if Rick.
My understanding is that there are adjustments based on cost of living, but the high cost serves to hurt us out here.
Okay, so this is a diagram that just kind of depicts what I was mentioning. So the credits are an IRS program federally. It gets allocated to the state. The state issues their qualified allocation plan with their funding priorities. And then there's a competitive process for the 9% tax credits and actually becoming more competitive for the 4% credits. But those are then allocated to the developer. They're sold to an institutional investor or syndicated, which is kind of the broker process, and then those dollars are available to actually build the developments.
Quick question. When the federal tax reform went into effect, there was an idea that changing the corporate tax burden would make people less interested in participating in the tax credit program. That doesn't seem to have played out, right? That's not...
We saw a dip when we went to the 21% corporate tax rate, but they're still very competitive. In fact, we just closed Mariners Village Housing Commission asset, and we got a dollar in tax credit equity pricing on a 4% deal. So they're still very competitive.
Thank you.
Historically, this was an emerging industry in the 90s. And initially, Basically, what you're, when a developer is looking for a tax credit partner, is looking for somebody basically to sell them money. It's a good way to think of it. And you get a certain number of cents on the dollar on your allocation. And when this program got started in the early 90s, they were actually being paid 40 to 50 cents on the dollar because it was seen as a risky endeavor, never been done before. And there were, frankly, a good number of failures way back when. I saw one of them in Richmond, Virginia, that just wasted a bunch of money. So, but then over time, as it became more efficient, more accepted in the marketplace, their interest rate rose. In the 8 years I worked for a tax credit investor in Chicago, the National Equity Fund, just before moving here in 08, and from 2000 to 2008, I saw our returns on this as an investor go from 12 cents to 3 cents on the dollar because of competition and people willing to sell money, more money at cheaper rates to the developer. So in one way, it's complicated, but this utilizes a private sector method of harnessing finance, which makes it hard to understand, but it also makes it pretty efficient. On the back end, it also utilizes the IRS rather than HUD to enforce it. You don't mess with the IRS. So what it means is that it keeps these properties in constant good use, or else it loses some investors some big money. Now, a further answer to your question, Madam Chair, is that if the rates go down, then investors have less interest, and that can drive down their bids on particular investment vehicles here. And that I've seen fluctuate greatly over the last 30 years. It is a marketplace mechanism. But if you get interest rates down to what they are right now, conversely, it makes this more attractive to an investor. So it's a lot of marketplace vagaries here that you almost need a logarithm to understand as opposed to straight algebra.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about the types of tax credits. So I think most people have probably heard about 4% and 9% tax credits. So generally speaking, 9% credits provide substantially more equity than the 4% tax credits, but are much harder to obtain. And there are two competitive 9% rounds each year in California. Traditionally, 4% credits have been non-competitive, but due to increased demand for bonds, they are recently becoming harder to obtain. Tax credits are able to pay for the majority of construction-related items and can fund anywhere from 30 to 70% of the total development cost of a project.
So what, we're just looking at this from the standpoint of affordable housing financing. What else is affordable housing as a sector? What else is it competing against for the 4% tax credits? Because I believe you'd mentioned to me that the part of the competitiveness is not, it's not just an increase in affordable housing production. Unfortunately, it's us having to compete with completely unrelated housing.
Sure. So at the for the bond side of it, Mike will speak to the tax credit side of it. On the bond side of it, the bond cap competes with things like the light rail train and water treatment plants and other things like that. So you'll have a section of the cap that will be on housing, and then you have a large number on these large industrial projects. And depending on what is in the queue, you'll have a lot of pressure on the cap.
Also, if there is a major infrastructure program in this country federally going forward, that will perversely have a negative effect on 4% tax credits going with the tax exempt bond financing, unless the cap is raised.
I wanted to point that out because that, as soon as you had mentioned that to me last month, it sort of blew my mind that there's all these things that we may at some point have to think about that we haven't had to. Perverse outcome there is the right way to put it, that we could be undercutting affordable housing production by investing in other infrastructure.
And just to help put into context, that had not been the case until this year. So previously, the 4% credits and the bonds were undersubscribed. So, just kind of the general impression of it was that if you had a development that you were bringing forward, you'd be able to get the 4% credits and bonds. And now the state has had to put together a competitive process because they're anticipating that they're going to be oversubscribed.
One more question. So in response to the competitiveness, how are developers, is there anything changing with their applications? Is there anything changing with how they're viewing their production and how to better compete? Or is it just sort of, it is what it is and they keep doing the same thing? And
so they definitely have to adjust, like we did with the corporate tax rates, that the industry needs to adjust. What we have seen is this large inclination to throw as many applications in every particular available round. It puts, again, a lot of pressure on the whole chain. And they're also looking at other creative financing solutions, like money that's flowing from the state. So.
Plus, there are every business discipline has its own advocacy group in Washington, D.C., for good reason, because it's the law of unintended consequences that is the biggest law that comes out of that city. Where one thing affects another, they don't know, the lawmakers don't know it until after the fact. So you find a lot of advocacy efforts to make sure that when, and let's say if we do get an increase in or get some sort of an infrastructure bill, I'm sure there's going to be enough advocacy interest in D.C. so that that's known. How it all gets worked out, I can't tell you. But that's one reason so many of us spend so much time there, is making sure that the voices are heard, issues are understood, because in a way, this is all connected. It's just not always obvious how it is.
Okay. We wanted to talk a little bit about the participants in a tax credit transaction, and we have quite a few financial partners that are listed up here just to make the argument that it takes a village to put one of these together. But we also wanted to highlight that locally, the Housing Commission, this agency, this board, is the most important participant in the tax credit program. So we allocate bonds, we allocate soft funding, we allocate vouchers. We really are the body that makes these deals work, and that's why you see so many of them and why we want to, you know, maintain specific focus on this. But a lot of other participants, the state level, the federal level, and also the private institutional lenders and investors. And these are just a few of the examples. We talked about tax credit syndicators and investors, including National Equity Fund, Boston Capital, Richmond, WNC. We have actively worked with these groups at the Housing Commission on developments, Citibank, U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo. We also see institutional big corporations invest in tax credits. So you'll see Exxon, Microsoft, Nationwide Insurance. So it really does create this public-private partnership that has really enjoyed bipartisan support and has been hugely successful, in part due to the public-private nature of it. And this is just another snapshot of some of the other players that are involved on the development side. So we have construction teams, we have sellers of land and buildings, design team, lawyers, accountants. Really, it's quite a large group to make these deals work. So now we're going to talk a little bit more about the technical side of how tax credits are calculated. And again, feel free just to jump in, because this stuff is pretty complicated. But we wanted to sort of share just kind of on the basic level, like what a tax credit actually is. And it is a dollar-for-dollar reduction in tax liability. So this is just kind of taking you through how it can affect the actual amount that a corporation is going to pay for taxes. So in this example, if they had $1.3 million in taxable income, they would net out some deductions, and then their taxable income would be $1 million in this example. At a 21% corporate tax rate, which has changed, they would have a liability of $210,000. So at this point, they would be writing a check for $210,000, but they would have an opportunity to go out and to purchase tax credits. If they were to go out and purchase tax credits for $110,000 in support of an affordable housing project, that $210,000 tax liability would now be $100,000, because they would get a dollar-for-dollar reduction for buying those tax credits. And this is a little bit more about how the tax credits are calculated. So it's really based on eligible basis and eligible costs. So we'll put forth a development pro forma that will have acquisition, building cost, construction costs, architects, a lot of the other components that go into these pro formas that are considered eligible basis. So we determine what that eligible basis is. We use an applicable fraction, which is the percentage of the building that is going to be for affordable housing tenants. It's multiplied by basis boost. In a lot of parts of San Diego, you can get 130%. And then you have your tax credit basis, and that's what the state agencies are going to use to allocate your tax credits. And this is a lot of numbers on a – I'm sorry, go ahead. Correct. Yep, it's part of the IRS program. And the only difference here is that some areas are eligible for the 130% basis boost and some are not. So a lot of San Diego is in a high-cost area or an area that could be called a qualified census tract or difficult development area that allows for the boost.
One, I heard you use the term I need to advise you all about. You used the term other housing commissions. Most housing commissions don't do this. We're unique. In most localities, either the city does it, the city redevelopment agency or community development agency does it, or a regional authorization does it. There are very few housing commissions or housing authorities that are local that do this. We're unique. And what you're hearing today in both these workshops today are two efforts that you're not going to find replicated in 5% of the agencies like us across the country.
So this next slide obviously has a lot of numbers on here, but a couple of the key numbers to focus on is that the total development cost for this project is $39 million. And we're trying to compare how much equity is generated with the 4% tax credit program versus the 9% tax credit program. So we take the eligible basis, which we just discussed. We look at the tax credit equity price, the amount the investor is willing to pay for the tax credit, and then we determine how much equity is going to go into this project. So for a 4% deal, this is generating about $12 million, and for a 9% deal, it's about $24 million. So this is where you can see that roughly about 30% of the cost for 4% deals can be generated by the equity, which is typically non-competitive, although recently changing. But a 9% deal can generate 60 to 70% of the total development cost just from the tax credits alone, which is why they're more competitive. So then we talk about other sources of financing. So if we're looking at, you know, those models of tax credits covering between 30 to 70%, we also have to fill the gap, the difference between what the equity is going to provide and the total development costs. And we see some other programs, many of which the Housing Commission administers, and many of the items we bring before you for loans and grants requests are really intended to help fill that gap. So we have tax-exempt bonds, which tie to the 4% credits. We have soft loans. The Section 8 voucher program goes a long way to helping these projects get private loans and grants. I'm sorry, private loans and mortgages. And then we also have funding for supportive services that play a key role in the permanent supportive housing projects. And more specifically, some of these programs from the Housing Commission include home dollars that we allocate, CDBG, housing trust funds, inclusionary and lieu fees, and then some other programs that you'll commonly hear about from the Federal Home Loan Bank, the AHP program, or the State Mental Health Services Act, MHSA. That's administered through the county, but a lot of our permanent supportive housing projects will partner with the county and bring those funds in as well.
A term I'd like to use for this is lasagna financing. Got a lot of layers in there. And basically use the layers to buy down the cost to address a lower and lower income population base. For instance, if you use a tax credit, straight tax credit deal, which is designed to fit basically somebody at 50 to 60% of median income, if you need to serve a homeless population or an elderly population, well, that may be more like 15 to 30% of the median income in the area, they can't even pay the rent for something affordable for somebody 50% of median. So you have to use another subsidy vehicle to buy it down. So what we'll do frequently, particularly on the homelessness deals or elderly deals, is we'll piggyback in vouchers to buy down the cost so that it'll serve a lower and lower income population. Because bottom line, you got to pay the bill somehow. And the tax credits is a supply-side effort that will buy it down to a point, and then you'll use other forms to buy it down further from that.
Services funding. Statements. The governor made a comment in his State of the State that the counties are sitting on a bunch of mental health services from the proposition in reserves, and he basically said, if you don't spend it, we're going to spend it for you. Is some of that money in this bucket, this state mental health services funding, or?
Yeah, we frequently use it, as a matter of fact. So I know that locally, as it's administered, they have funding priorities for different supportive housing projects. So they may have allocated for veterans, or they may have at-risk youth, or they may have seniors, and they have priorities that may shift, and they may need to wait for project to come in to make sure they hit all their funding priorities. But by and large, this is competitive, and these monies go out.
Yeah, but again, the governor's comment was, I think San Diego has $70 million in reserve. San Diego County does?
There's been some frustration with San Diego's spending of it, and the Mental Health Services Act funding is in four different buckets, right? And some of those buckets are spent at different timings. But the county has been better about spending it lately, I feel. And I think Lisa has been kind of the go-between between the county and Housing Commission for a variety of these sorts of discussions. Lisa, can we bug you about County Mental Health Services Act spending? Sorry, and if I'm out of line on this.
Actually, I'm probably not the best person to speak to that, but thank you for thinking that I am.
Well, hey, I often just say Lisa knows the answer.
We have a taker.
Ask Lisa.
I'll take that one. So with any sort of funding source that you get more of that you're not anticipating, you have to build infrastructure around that. So the county has been doing that. They've been putting the infrastructure in place that, quite frankly, the Housing Commission already has to deploy those funds. So they were slow, but they're going to get there. So,
just direct question. The governor said if you're sitting on a bunch of reserves, spend it. So my question is that does that mean that the county now has to look at ways to get some of that money? Could some of that money be sent out the door as part of, as Rick put it, the lasagna financing that will be necessary to build some of this housing?
The short answer is yes, sir.
Okay.
The longer answer is it'll depend on building the relationships and cut a deal in order to get it transferred.
So that should be a focus. Okay.
I'll just make one more comment on that. So we've been very successful in our partnerships with the county with our permanent supportive housing projects. So we've utilized those funds at the Hotel Churchill, at the Mason Hotel, at Quality Inn, at West Park, and New Palace. So it's been a really successful program and a partnership. They not only provide capital dollars, they also provide the supportive service dollars, which are really hard to come by.
So actually two more questions on the gap finance, because the gap financing is pretty curious to me. So in this context, when we're talking about gap financing, not mental health service dollars that we're using, for example, in shelters, right? We're only talking about this applying in permanent supportive housing, in a permanent supportive housing context, right? To help finance the project as a whole, by, because those services are going to be on site, then we can tap into that money, which helps close the gap to make the finance, to make the project pencil out. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yes.
So in this context, we would be constrained on how much of that we could spend by the number of permanent supportive housing projects that we have in the cards, right? Like, we couldn't increase our utilization of that unless we had more permanent supportive housing projects coming down the pipeline that were financed in other ways, right?
Definitely. So it all is timing, right? Yeah. Because the development cycle isn't, hey, we give you this, it magically appears tomorrow. There is a life cycle of a project. And so we'll have a period of time where the pipeline is robust. We'll see other deals. We want to see a variety of deals, and then we'll see those cycle back. So yes, pipeline does play a lot into it.
Have we had any, since that funding stream has been available, have we had any permanent supportive housing projects where we did not utilize the mental health services funding as part of the gap financing?
You do see deals where that's not part of the capital stack, and it's just that they are successful in other funding sources. But for the most part, that is a source.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I could think of it backwards from the question, and that is, until November the 12th, 2014, we didn't do any permanent supportive housing, this organization. We did NOFAs, Notices of Fund Availability for Affordable Housing. And when we launched our Housing First San Diego plan, set of plans at that point, we separated out some of the money as permanent supportive housing. And that was one that the development community had to get used to and learn how to operate. And we would require services, and they would have to figure out a way to bring services to the table to compete and get them air gap financing or to get an authorization in the first place. So they could bring in, say, mental health services money, or they could bring in the funding from other places. But the developers would have to show us how they would do it as a condition for getting the award.
So in that context, then, the only scenario in which this wouldn't be part of the stack in permanent supportive housing would be if the developer essentially didn't need it. They had financed the infrastructure around the mental health services in a way that did not require them to.
Correct. So they'll use other partnerships. They'll use other resources to sort of put their deal together.
Okay. And then one more question on CDBG. I'm sorry to get into that. I feel like I finally have like just enough knowledge to be a little bit dangerous and get like a little further into the weeds. Cause I remember this from, I think probably a year ago where we did something similar. I don't think I had so many questions last time. So the CDBG funding, I don't know if you've seen the issue that came up that Councilmember Moreno raised around the use of CDBG funds. This came up in the context of the streetlight cameras, but it was a larger point that she made about CDBG funding and how it's treated, and I'll kind of summarize here. The concern is that the communities that are supposed to be benefiting from CDBG is that CDBG funds are often used to just backfill a different funding source. And so that was a good example because she pointed out that every community received the same service in that context, which was the cameras, right? But the CDBG funds for her community were utilized to pay for it there, whereas other funding sources were utilized other places, which sort of raises the question, it's really not benefiting the community anymore if we're just backfilling with that. So, and it sort of altered the way that I look at CDBG funding. Obviously, supporting affordable housing is a great use of CDBG funds. My question, my concern would be, especially as this, I think people are starting to look at this more closely and see whether CDBG is really doing what it's supposed to be doing, is are we like being cognizant of the fact that if it's backfilling what could be financed with a different funding source, that essentially we're sort of wasting that community, you know, the benefit that community is supposed to be getting out of those dollars.
So I'll speak to it from a Housing Commission standpoint. The CDBG dollars that we get are for a dedicated purpose. So we'll get them for permanent supportive housing, if you will, and we deploy them as such. What the city is grappling with, although we may feel some of the implications of that, the dollars we receive, we deploy them as they're intended to be deployed.
Got it. That is very helpful. And so presumably, that's sufficient. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. So now we have some pretty pictures of tax credit projects that the Housing Commission has financed. So Zephyr Apartments, Alpha Lofts, Luna, Mesa Verde, and our favorite, near and dear to our heart, San Diego Square Apartments, which is just outside the window here, which is a Housing Commission project that we completed with 4% tax credits about 4 years ago. I know, it's been a while. So that concludes our presentation. Were there any additional questions or comments?
Questions or comments from commissioners? Nothing held over? No? Mr. Gentry?
Just wanted to belabor the point further. This particular arena is one that we're fairly unique in this industry. So when you all go to some of the professional association conferences, which I hope you do, you're going to hear comments about the San Diego model. We were not formed as a housing organization until 1979. And San Diego was the last major city in the country to form one of these. And as examples, the three other local agencies I work for, Greensboro, North Carolina, was formed in 1948, Richmond, Virginia, 1940, Austin, Texas, in 1937. We were formed in 1979. And by the time you got to the 70s, the world, as opposed to the 30s and 40s and 50s, the world had changed. many state housing finance agencies were set up in the very early 70s. There were not housing, local housing finance operations of any sort. And so that what the founders of this organization did when we were chartered in the late 70s was to add in other powers that typically cities have aggrandized onto themselves or are farmed out to non-local housing agencies. And what that does for us is unique, is what attracted me to this job, that and getting out of Chicago weather. And that is that we're able to put a lot of things together here. Most organizations will have the standard federal programs of Section 8 vouchers, public housing, and in latter years they might have done a tax credit deal or two themselves. The way this agency was chartered and then amended in the late 80s so that we can generate third-party owned properties, I think has been unique in the country, and it's been very, very good for San Diego. You know, instead of this agency itself operating 30 or 40,000 units, we have basically been brokers to set up other private sector, both for-profit and non-profit groups to do it. And I think it served the city extremely well in general over the years. Perhaps not enough, but it's been a good end product. We've had, I don't think, any failures here during that time. My intent today was to make sure that we start this process of y'all understanding that we manage the money and the asset value of our operations in addition to just doing property management. That, too, is fairly unique for this industry. And what I'll tell the board is that for any one of our senior VPs, I consider the private sector term called an officer of the company. So any senior VP here has my authorities to deal with you all directly on issues. And what I would ask you is that if you have other questions about the stuff, you want to see how it works, you want to make sure you understand it thoroughly, we're open to you anytime you want. If something we can't answer, then we'll figure out another way of doing it. But also that over the time, this has changed as well, as we've added homelessness stuff to it and other disciplines as well. But this is one that is the most complicated part of what we do tends to get a lot of consumer input, as you heard from the public earlier this morning. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And just briefly for the fellow commissioners, there is a very large sheet of paper that outlines the status of recently approved projects, things that we talked about. It does outline as well sources of financing. And it's just a nice reminder of some of the progress that's been made. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that. We are going to thank staff for committing to speak to us, for producing these reports, and for continuing to keep us educated. Thank you for this presentation. We are moving the workshop on homelessness programming to next month. Thank you for sitting through this and for being volunteered as experts on all things. Thank you guys as always. But we do have a late speaker request for non-agenda public comment. While it is not the appropriate time for that, we want to make sure that somebody who has made time to come down here has the opportunity to address the board. So I would like to invite Bertha Lopez up. You'll have 3 minutes, and following that, we will conclude the meeting.
I apologize for the lateness of, I wasn't aware of the procedures. This is my first time here. My name is Bertha Lopez. I am disabled. I care for my son that's disabled, and we're currently homeless. I have been homeless since January with him. I have been on Section 8 wait list for over 12 years. Last year, I was finally picked, but I wasn't notified. So when I became homeless in January, I was given with Greg Hawk's office a fast process to try to get a voucher because I have waited a long time and do need one. But I want to let you know that there's nothing out there for disabled people. And I've only heard mental health one time. And the government, actually, the agencies are at fault for people like me, because I'm not the only one, and I've learned a lot, that I get the government guidelines, for income guidelines, are the problem, because I was denied the Section 8. And I live off of Social Security, and my father lends me money, and I pay him back, and things like that. Well, they counted that as income. I have been in the hospital already once for 3 days. My son is not doing well. I don't qualify for hotel vouchers because I do get Social Security. According to that, it's a lot of money for our income guidelines. There is nothing out there for the mental health and homelessness. And I just want to speak so in the future, you can take in consideration that people that are not, I think we're like a minority, the disabled, and there's nothing out there. So I will continue being homeless. And I was put back on the waiting list. But the truth is, I'm not going to ever qualify anymore because it's too much money with my Social Security check.
I'd like to make sure that staff is able to follow up with you. Thank you. If you wouldn't mind, Austin, in the back, will you wave just so she can see? Bertha, if you wouldn't mind, turn around so you can see. That's who you'll want to make sure that you get to connect with, and we'll see what we can do. And as well as Lisa Jones right next to you. Thank you for coming down to speak.
I'm sorry. I didn't.
No. No. Don't apologize. It's okay. Thank you for being here. Thank you for raising that. We appreciate that. With that, if there's any final remarks, I think we'll conclude the meeting. Thank you. We're adjourned.